Exodus 1, 8 through 10, and 2, 23 through 3, 14. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war breaks out, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." During those many days, the king of Egypt died, and the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, "I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned." When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hands of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a land, to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppress them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." But Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He said, "But I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain." Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." And he said, "Say this to the people of Israel, 'I am has sent me to you.'" This is the word of the Lord. Thank you. Please be seated.
Just a few weeks ago, at the beginning of September, we started an annual focus, a year-long study of the Bible as God's story of creation, rebellion, redemption, and new creation with Jesus at the center. And as we come to this first week in October, congratulations, we finished one book, one down, 65 to go. But we're still in the first section of the Bible, the five books of Torah. And Torah literally means instruction. I like to think of the Torah as God's instructions for living in God's world. If the Torah was to have a title, it might be something like God creates the universe and calls a people. And it moves us from creation and rebellion to the edge of the promised land. That's where it starts and that's where it ends. And it moves there through Abraham's family, Exodus, and wilderness. And so we've done sermons on creation and rebellion. We've had a couple sermons on Abraham's family. And today we arrive at the Exodus. And as we approach the book of Exodus, what we see right in the first chapter of the book is that the Exodus story is a continuation of the story we read in Genesis. And remember, it's all God's story. You see that right in Exodus chapter 1, verse 8. "Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph." Immediately, right here, first few verses of the next book, it's connecting you back to what happened in the last book of Genesis. Last week, we studied Joseph's story, and we talked about God's intervention and what it looks like. And what God's intervention looked like in the story of Joseph was mysterious, and it took place in the midst of the meanwhiles of our lives. Exodus continues this theme of God's intervention and how it brings about our redemption. But in Exodus, the emphasis is not on God's intervention in its mysterious ways or its meanwhile ways. You see, something I read this week just stopped me in my tracks, and I thought, I've got to ponder that for a moment. I read this: the world of Exodus is where the holiness of God lives in staggering response to the hurt of slaves. The holiness of God in staggering response to the hurt of slaves, to the hurt of his people. And so what we see in Exodus is God's power breaks through. That's the theme. It's not the mysterious power of God or the meanwhile power of God. It's God's power, raw and unfettered, breaking through into our lives to rescue and to redeem his people. And so as we have done in the spirit of Deuteronomy chapter 31, where this annual focus comes from this morning, as we look at the Exodus story, we will listen to, we will learn from, we will live by, and we will consider how we might let others know about God's power breaking through in the story of Exodus. So let's listen to that story. It starts off with God's people in Egypt doing exactly what God instructed the first man and the first woman, Adam and Eve, to do, which is to be fruitful and to multiply. God's people have multiplied greatly in the land of Egypt. If you remember, how did they get to the land of Egypt? There was a great famine in the land where God called them, the land of Canaan, the promised land, where ultimately the story of Torah will end, right on the border, the boundary of that promised land. But for now, God moved them with this famine into the land of Egypt, and they've grown very prosperous. And a new Pharaoh, a new king, is sitting on the throne who doesn't remember the great things that Joseph did and how Joseph saved not just God's people, but the entire land of Egypt during this great famine. And he says, these people are getting too numerous. They're going to outnumber us. And what if they started a war? We might not be able to win that war. And so he begins to oppress them, and he enslaves them to build his cities in Egypt. The story, the book of Exodus records that the more the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, oppressed God's people, the more fruitful they were, the more they multiplied. So he said, I'm going to have to get a little more aggressive in my tactics here. And he says, he puts a policy into place that every male child born among God's people, the Hebrews, shall be killed. And so this policy just hung over God's people. Just dread and fear. How are we going to survive? Our children are being killed. And chapter 2 of Exodus starts off with a man and a woman from the tribe of Levi who have a son, and they just can't bear to imagine Pharaoh killing their son. And so they take reeds from the Nile River, and they make a basket. And then they put some pitch on the basket. It's the same word that's used for what Noah used to make the ark waterproof. And they cover that basket with this tar and this pitch, and they send their child down the Nile River right as Pharaoh's daughter is out to wash and to bathe in the Nile. Pharaoh's daughter finds this child and has compassion on the child. She's not going to follow her father's policy to have this child killed. And Moses' sister is watching this all happen. And Moses' sister offers to find a woman to nurse this child from among the Hebrew people. And Pharaoh's daughter says, that's a great idea. And so Moses is nursed by his own mother. But after some time, she knew that she had to send him back to Pharaoh's household. And so they get their little boy ready, and they bring him back to Pharaoh's daughter. And Pharaoh's daughter is the one who names him Moses. The word Moses literally means to draw out. She says, I drew him out of the Nile. And again, in Exodus, God's power breaks through. And this is the first moment where you see God's power break through. It's in the name of Moses that he was drawn out of the Nile and right into Pharaoh's court, right into the palace of the most powerful man in the universe, unbeknownst to him, without him ever even having a hint of what could be going on here, God has drawn Moses out and he's drawn him in to Pharaoh's palace. God's power breaks through. Moses grows up in the palace of Pharaoh, raised as an Egyptian, but knows he is one of the Hebrew people. And when he gets older, he sees the oppression of God's people and he lashes out one day and strikes one of Pharaoh's guards. The man ends up dying and Moses flees, a fugitive of the law, goes to a land called Midian. And in this land called Midian, he meets some women who are watering their flocks by a well. The women mistake him for an Egyptian. Just tuck that away in your mind. We'll come back to that. But whenever you see movies about Exodus, Moses looks like one of the Hebrews, one of the Jews. But he was raised in Pharaoh's palace. They think he's an Egyptian. They go back, they say to their dad, "An Egyptian saved us." And the dad says, "Well, aren't you going to invite him to dinner?" So they go back and they get Moses and they invite him to dinner. And the father, his name's Jethro, gives one of his daughters to Moses in marriage. They have a child. And Moses names the child alien or sojourner or foreigner. The word is Gershom in Hebrew. He says, "I'm never going back. I'm an alien in a foreign land and my home will never be my home again." But in Exodus, God's power breaks through. And in the next chapter, you see Moses tending sheep and a bush is on fire, yet it is not being consumed by the fire. And God begins to speak to Moses out of this bush and say, "I'm sending you back to Egypt to save my people. My power is breaking through and my power is going to break through you, Moses. You're the instrument I'm going to get to use." God gives him the promise of his very name, which in the Bible, name signifies identity. God gives Moses the name and identity of God and sends him back to Egypt. Pharaoh's heart is hardened by what Moses has to say, as one whose whole economy depends on this slave labor force. Pharaoh's not going to let the people go. And now I'm in chapter 7 of the story. Pharaoh's heart is hardened. And so in Exodus, what happens? God's power breaks through. And it breaks through in the form of plagues. And the plagues take many forms. There's water in the Nile that's turned to blood. There's a plague of frogs, a plague of gnats, a plague of flies, a plague on the livestock, a plague of hail, a plague of locusts, a plague of darkness, and ultimately a final plague of death. And we'll get into the plagues a little bit more, but for right now, as we listen to the story, what we need to know about the plagues is this is God's power breaking through. And how God's power breaks through is through all of creation. All of creation is mobilized on behalf of the redemption of God's people. As we go through these plagues, a question that I think the book of Exodus is getting at is, where will God's people go for shelter in the midst of God's power breaking through, in the midst of God's wrath breaking out, in the midst of Egypt experiencing God's judgment? Where will God's people go for shelter, for covering? It's especially clear in the final plague, the plague of death. Everyone can survive the earlier plagues, but not this final plague, the plague of death. And so God gives them a festival. It's called Passover. And they are to take a lamb and slaughter the lamb and take the blood of the lamb and paint the doorpost of their house so that when God comes through to bring about the plague of death over the firstborn of every child in every Egyptian's household, including that of Pharaoh, he will see the blood of the lamb and he will pass over that house. And God's power breaks through in a terrible and awful way as the Egyptians wake in the middle of the night to find death throughout the land. And Pharaoh finally relents and says, "Get out of here. Go, take your people and leave." But God's power breaks through in great and powerful ways, but also in subtle ways. There's a little note in the book of Exodus that says God didn't lead them the most direct way to where they were going, the mountain of God. God led them in a roundabout way that would ultimately get them to the Red Sea. And Pharaoh changes his mind and chases God's people down. And their backs are up against the Red Sea. And they go, we're done. We should have just, it would have been better to be slaves in Egypt than to die out here in the wilderness or to die drowning in the Red Sea. But remember, in Exodus, God's power breaks through. And God's power breaks through the Red Sea and creates a way where there was no way. And God's people walk on dry ground across the Red Sea. And Pharaoh's army goes after them. And ultimately, God's people are safe on the other side. And the waters come crashing down. And Pharaoh's army is destroyed. And this is the last verse of Exodus 14. Exodus 14, 31. The point of the whole narrative. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So the people feared the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. Israel saw the great power of God. In Exodus, God's power breaks through. That's the story if we listen to the story. But we don't just want to listen to the story. What can we learn from the story? Remember last week we learned that God's intervention that led to our redemption came about mysteriously and meanwhile. And in Exodus we learn that God's intervention is powerful, it's present, and it's personal. But not quite personal in the way we think of it. And I'll get to that in a moment. The powerful nature of the God's intervention in the book of Exodus is demonstrated most clearly through the plagues. And the plagues go over several chapters. And what you see, if I was to try to summarize the plagues and the power that they show, is this: that the plagues show God's power over all aspects of life. Social, economic, religious, and political. All aspects of life, the plagues show God's power and dominion over them. Here's how you might organize the plagues according to this idea. The idea of God showing power over the social aspects of life. The plague of blood where the Nile turned to blood. The frogs, the gnats, the flies. These are all plagues that would lead to one, maybe a public health crisis, that the society, the social fabric of the society would be frayed by experiencing these plagues. And some of them were just frustrating or annoying. It's hard to have a conversation with someone when gnats are all around. It's hard to be intimate with your wife when frogs are in your bed. And so you see the social... I didn't say that in the first service. I don't know why that came out, but I see it connected with everyone on a deep level here. So they have frogs, and it says the frogs are in their very beds. Very hard to have a society with frogs in your bed. It shows God's power over the economic dimensions of life. It says the livestock are killed. That was a great economic driver for Egypt. And once all the livestock were killed, well, who's going to plow the fields now? Well, maybe people could plow the fields, but no, they got boils. So not only the animals can't work, now the people can't work. And once the people were healed, okay, we're going to go back to work. Hail comes and flattens all the crops. And again, as if to show God's complete and total power over the economic aspects of life, what the hail didn't crush, the locust came and ate. It shows God's power over the religious aspects of life. As the darkness came, the Egyptians were confronted with the fact, oh, maybe the sun god Ra is not really God at all. Maybe there's one more powerful than what we believed was God. And then the political aspects of life. The death, the plague of death, goes after not just the lowly and the laborers of Egypt. It goes into Pharaoh's very house itself. And their king and the heir to the throne is taken down by these plagues. God's power is displayed over all aspects of life. But God's intervention is not only powerful, it's present. It's present to the needs of God's people. If you look at Exodus chapter 2, verses 23 and 24, you'll read this. During those many days, the king of Egypt died, And the people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. And listen to these verbs about God. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the people of Israel, and God knew. That in the Joseph story, we see God mysteriously working in the meanwhiles of our lives. And in the Exodus story, we see that God is powerfully present to the pain of his people. Right then, immediate, he sees it. He remembers. He knows their pain. He hears their pain. And how often have we been in pain and suffering in our lives and said, can anyone see me right now? I'm wilting on the inside. Maybe I'm at work with a happy face and I'm getting my job done, but I am wilting on the inside. Can anyone even see that happening? Does anyone hear my cries for help, subtle or audible? Does God even remember me? And if God did remember me, could he even know what I'm going through? And the truth of the gospel, as opposed to any other claim to religious truth in the world, the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ is that God not only can know our pain, he does know it personally and quite intimately, as he was made fully present in Jesus Christ and suffered on a cross. The Bible says he was a man of sorrow and suffering, and people esteemed him not. God heard, God remembered, God saw, God knew. God's power is present to the needs of his people, but God's power is also quite personal. See, I said it's personal, but not maybe in the way that we would think it's personal. When you think God is personal, oh, God's going to personally handle this himself, and that's what it seems like is going to happen. In Exodus chapter 3, verse 8, God says many of those same verbs, I've seen it, I've heard it, I'm remembering, and then he says in verse 8, and so I've come down. I am coming down, Exodus 3:8, to deliver my people. You go, okay, great. God's going to handle this personally. But look at verse 10. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. I have come down, but I'm sending you, Moses. I'm partnering with you to get it done. The person that's going to show up is Moses. And so what we learn in this section is not just that God's intervention is powerful, present, and personal. We learn that God's intervention becomes an invitation. God's intervention becomes an invitation to Moses to show up on God's behalf, to be used for God's purposes of redemption in the world. See, the most famous line that gets repeated over and over, especially in movies and Hollywood depictions of this story, you may know it when I say it. The line that gets repeated over and over again is when Moses says, "Let my people go." Moses shows up to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." But that's not the whole line in the Bible. If you look at Exodus chapter 7, verse 16, the full line is, let my people go that they may serve me. God's intervention becomes an invitation to be a part of what he is doing in this world. And so as God's power breaks through, God's invitation goes out. And so how might we live by this story of Exodus? If that's what we can learn from it, how might we live by the story? And I think there's a lot that we could apply to our lives from this story. Let me just go over at least two things that I think are exceedingly important when we walk through Exodus 1 to 14. We need to stop resisting and start remembering. Stop resisting, start remembering. The first one, stop resisting. As God invites Moses to be a part of his powerful, present, and personal intervention that will lead to the redemption of Israel, Moses resists by making five excuses. And if you want to know what Moses' five excuses are, here they are. Moses says, who am I? What is his name? They will say, but I am slow, and send someone else. Let me walk through these. The first one, and again, this is from Moses 3:11, Exodus 3:11. When God says, I'm coming down, but I'm sending you, the first thing Moses says, but who am I, God? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? I call this the me excuse. I'm nobody, God. I don't come from the right family. I don't have the right experience. I don't have the right education. This is the me excuse. And it's really interesting here. Because remember I said the women at the well, the daughters of Jethro, one of whom ultimately became Moses' wife, remember they thought that Moses was what? They thought he was an Egyptian. And what you see here is Moses is saying, I have this conflicted identity. Who am I? Am I an Egyptian? Am I for Pharaoh? Am I supposed to protect his kingship? Or am I one of God's children? I don't know, God. Who am I? And God's answer to Moses is so profound. God says to Moses, when he makes the me excuse, he says, I will be with you. In other words, who is Moses? Is he an Egyptian? Is he a Hebrew? Who is he? Moses, you are the one that God is with. And when we make the me excuse in our own lives, we say, but who am I? We say, remember, Jesus Christ said, behold, I will be with you always, even to the very end of the earth. And he sent his Holy Spirit to the church and to all who put their faith in him. Who am I? Who are you? We are the ones, like Moses, who God is with. The second excuse, what is his name? This comes in Exodus 3:13. Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask, what is his name? What shall I say to him? I call this the trust excuse. It's Moses saying, God, not who am I, but who are you? Do you have enough power to get this done? Do you have enough resources to get this done? Do you really know what you're doing? Not who am I, God, but who are you? And can I tell other people who you are? Will you reveal yourself to me? God answers this question by giving Moses his very name. And I want to show you something. I just took a picture of my Bible that when it says God said to Moses, who am I? Excuse me, when God said to Moses what his name is, I am who I am. You see, it's listed there in all capital letters. And the reason it's in all capital letters is the translators are attempting to tell you that the divine name, Yahweh, stands behind those capital letters. And here they're attempting to translate it for you. But every time you see the all capital letters, what's behind it, and usually it just gets said the Lord, out of awe and reverence that you don't want to say God's name flippantly. And so when you see the word Lord in all capital letters, that's the translators helping you see that God's divine name, Yahweh, YHWH, transliterated in the Hebrew, stands behind that English translation. And so God says, I am who I am, Moses, which gives Moses a great sense of God's power. I am, as we sang earlier, the uncreated one. I am the source of all being, Moses. I am who I am. Tell him the I am, the source of all being, sent me to you. You can also translate God's name a little differently, and it's in a footnote at the bottom in the ESV translation, or I am what I am, or I will be what I will be. And so I think I am what I am gets at the power of God as the source of being. And I will be what I will be gets at the freedom of God. I am free to act how I want to. I am free to redeem who I want to. I am God. I am powerful. And I am free. You can trust me, Moses. Next excuse, verse 4:1. Moses says, but I'm going to go to the people of Israel. And they're going to say, you know, did God really send you to us? I call this the what if excuse. You know, they're going to say, God, all of these nasty things about me. They're not going to believe me. What if, what if, what if, what if? And this is what we do to God all the time. We go, I would do that, God, but what if this happens? And I'm not prepared for that contingency. What if? What if, God? And then the fourth excuse, but I am slow. He says in Exodus 4:10, but God, I am slow of speech. I've never been good at speaking publicly, and now you want me to go give a speech to the most powerful man in the universe? I call this the skills excuse. I don't have the right skills. I don't have the right tools. I really just can't do this, God. And when God says to him, but who gave man his mouth? Who makes his tongue form words? I, the Lord, remember, I am Moses. Of course I'm going to help you speak. Moses' final excuse, he just says in Exodus 4:13, oh Lord, please just send someone else. I call this the, I don't need this excuse. I don't need this, God. It's just too much. Do you know what my life, how difficult my life is? Do you know what I'm already trying to get done? I just don't need this hassle, this headache. Just send someone else. And so I have a few questions for us coming out of these excuses. First, what's your Egypt? What's that place that God is asking you to go? What's that thing that God is asking you to do and you have been resisting? What's your Egypt? We all have one. What is it? Get it in your brain right now. Second question, what's your excuse? Is it the me excuse, the trust excuse, the what if excuse, the skills excuse, or the I don't need this excuse? What's your excuse? My third question, if you're not going to be obedient to God's call, if you're going to keep resisting and make these excuses, what else are you going to do with your life? If you're going to say no to God, what's your better alternative that you have created in your own infinite wisdom? What else are you going to do? This past Monday, I wanted to put into practice some of what we talked about last week about learning how to see better. And I wanted to go to a place where I could see far and I could pray and I could ask God how I could see better on some things in my own life. So I ended up on this deserted stretch of beach and there was a seagull there to comfort me. And he stayed with me for a long time. And most people go to the beach and there's two things they don't like about the beach. They don't like the sand. I love sand. I could have sand. I couldn't have frogs in my bed. I can handle sand in my bed. I love sand. And I love seagulls. People are always trying to get the seagulls away. I'm like, bring on, people feed the seagulls. Great, more seagulls, the better. And there was just this one seagull. He befriended me. He was like my little companion as I was praying. He sort of stood watch over me. And so I was having my lunch and eating this sandwich. And I know you're not supposed to do this, but I just thought, he's been so faithful to me. And I threw him a little piece of bacon for my sandwich. He loved it. So I threw him another little piece of bacon. And then I finished my sandwich. And then I was eating a garbanzo bean salad. Okay, sounds a little strange. It's really good, okay? So I had this garbanzo bean salad. And I had a lot of extra garbanzo beans in there, so I started throwing them the garbanzo beans. Here's a picture. Those are the garbanzo beans that I threw to the seagull. He goes, the first one, he picks it up, he eats it, and he immediately spits it back out. He didn't like the garbanzo beans. But of course, now I've been feeding the seagull, so what's going to happen? Other seagulls come by, and he becomes very protective of these garbanzo beans. So here's another bird, and he is just chasing him away. So I called this the guarding of the garbanzos, okay? That's what the seagull is doing. He's guarding the garbanzos, and he got fairly aggressive. He spread his wings. He's like, I will hover over the garbanzos. No one is allowed to touch these. And at one point, he started getting a little noisy. There's the beak wide open. He is coming after you. He is guarding the garbanzos. Remember, he didn't even like the garbanzos. They weren't even that good. He spit them back out. And I think this is a parable for our lives. We guard our garbanzos so tightly, don't we, in our life? We say no to what God is asking us to do because we say, you know, I've got this other thing over here that needs my protection. Well, how meaningful is that thing? Well, it's not as meaningful as what you've asked me to do, God, but I'm going to guard these garbanzos. How much life is this thing bringing into you or versus stress in just trying to care for it? It's not bringing a lot of life. It's no way it's going to bring more life than what you're asking me to do, God, but I'm going to guard these garbanzos. And whether it's an extra zero in our 401ks or a job that we know God has asked us to leave for something else, we guard it so vigorously. What's your Egypt? What's your excuse? And what else are you going to do if we're not going to obey God? Because God's intervention becomes an invitation. And so we must stop resisting this invitation and start remembering what God has done in his redemptive story. The first thing God's people do after God's power breaks out and finally destroys Pharaoh's army at the crossing of the Red Sea, the first thing God's people do, they sing. There's Moses' song, there's Miriam's song, and there's 50 other points of remembrance of the Exodus story in the Old Testament. Because when we remember God's powerful, present, and personal intervention for our redemption in the past, we are strengthened to say yes to his invitation in the present. And so my question is, what could remembering look like? If we were to say, I am going to remember how God has worked in my life. Maybe it's finally saying, yes, they keep talking about this E100 reading plan as we go through the Bible. I will get into God's word, or I will continue some of the practices I learned from the summer prayer challenge, or I'll finally get up on that watchtower and go get alone and actually say, God, help me see better. We must stop resisting and start remembering. And finally, we must let others know about Exodus 1 to 14, that Jesus brings about a new Exodus, and Jesus is the true Passover lamb. See, Jesus brings about a new Exodus. In Matthew chapter 2, we see Matthew point out that out of Egypt I called my son. Mary and Joseph had to flee to Egypt because of Herod's wrath. And so Jesus comes up out of Egypt as God's people came up out of Egypt. And Matthew is saying, don't you see? There's a new Exodus about to take place. A new Exodus that's going to bring freedom from sin and death. And if that wasn't clear enough, John in chapter 1 says, John the Baptist looks at Jesus and says, behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. He's the true Passover lamb. And in John 19, we see that it was the day of preparation when the Passover lambs were being slaughtered that Jesus is led out to be crucified. John is saying, don't you see? Don't you get it? It's under his blood that we take shelter from the judgment of God. It's in his blood that we find release from forces more powerful than Pharaoh, the forces of sin and death. It's in his blood that we're freed from all kinds of slavery to all the brick making enterprises of this world to serve the true Lord of heaven and earth. And so we come to the communion table because Jesus said, you come to this communion table to remember me. And so let's remember him. That in Exodus, God's power breaks through. His intervention is powerful, personal, and present. So let's stop resisting, start remembering, and let others know that Jesus, when we put our faith in him, brings about a new Exodus and a new freedom into our lives.